Hello and welcome to the 9th edition of the Roots Aviation Podcast. This is recorded live from Roots Europe 2018 in Bilbao, in the heart of the beautiful Basque Country.
Today you're going to hear from Alex Cruz, the Chairman and Chief Executive of British Airways, about his 2 years with the airline.
In a frank and engaging interview, Cruz discusses the airline's need to retain its premium standard and offer customers the service they expect.
He also talks about competition from long-haul low-cost operators and why BA's refurbished 777s are going to be its competitive weapon.
The interview took place as part of the conference programme for the event, which was sponsored by Embraer and was conducted by John Strickland, Director of JLS Consulting. So, over to John, and we hope you enjoy.
Alex, welcome to Bilbao. We've met many times before, but I think it's nearly always been in London, maybe Barcelona a few times. So welcome to your hometown.
I was going to say, it's me saying to you, welcome. Welcome
so
to
much.
Bilbao.
Well, you could have invited
welcome
me out
everyone
for,
to Bilbao.
You could have invited me out for a few tapas, Alex.
I mean, well, yeah, we will.
Later on. Listen, Alex, I mean, how does it feel coming back here? I mean, just in terms of, you know, you were born and bred here, but your life in aviation has been spelled elsewhere. What do you feel about Bilbao as an airport and its future?
Well, first of all, it's amazing to be here at an aviation event in Bilbao. Finally, an event in Bilbao in aviation. So it's really fantastic to hang around with old friends from both airlines and airports that are coming here to come together. But beyond that, for the local authorities and for, frankly, the rest of the local citizens to show off. Bilbao has evolved as a city tremendously since I was born many moons ago, and it is a great opportunity to show off and show it to everyone. So, great pleasure.
I was in a taxi last night with my two or three words of Spanish and his bit of English. He was saying to me, "No, this airport is growing." And you know, your previous life immediately to BA was Vueling. I think, isn't Vueling the largest operator here in Bilbao?
Yes.
And obviously BA flies several times a day as well. Aer Lingus in here, so it's pretty important airport for the
IAG. Of course, Iberia,
Iberia as well. Of course,
so just about every airline of the group is flying
absolutely
to Bilbao, that's right.
Now, we first met, you were at Click Air, then became a CEO of Vueling. But 2 years ago, you were asked to take the hot seat at British Airways, a very different airline in scale, in history. I think you're the first, I'm not sure, maybe the first non-Brit to run the airline.
Oh, there's been Australian,
yeah,
Irish,
that's true. Yeah,
how could Irish.
I say, yeah, that's true. How could I say that?
Yeah,
completely wrong there. But how did it feel to, how did it feel to go into that hot seat? I mean, when you were asked a question, do you want to take this role? Were you sad to leave Vueling? Did you think maybe, well, this is not maybe the thing for me? Or was it simply excitement at the prospect?
There was nothing new at British Airways in terms of an industry perspective. Mm-hmm. Airplanes, destinations, managing sales, finance, all these kinds of things that were not new to me. What was new to me was the size. It's more than 300 airplanes, it's 45,000 people in the team. And for me, that has been the biggest challenge in mm-hmm. many respects. Is getting a good grip of the size, understanding that I'm not going to be able to know everyone by name, mm-hmm. all 45,000,
yeah.
And actually beginning to develop new ways to engage, not just with our own staff, but also with passengers at large. And I think that has been the focus, and it will be the focus of BA over the years to come.
As you say, the scale of the company, and it's been through changes. It was already, under Willie Walsh and indeed CEOs before him, having to adapt to changes in the market, but the pace has quickened. Is there a challenge of people who've worked in BA perhaps for their whole careers to understand that need for change, or do they feel threatened in some way that their company is being asked to do what it shouldn't be asked
yeah,
to do?
Yes and no. In many ways, BA has led change in Europe for many, many years. It's a company that began to take tough decisions, acknowledging the marketplace way before everyone else. Yeah. It was the first airline that created an airline within the airline in mm-hmm. Europe, and is the one that has tried just about every model. So it has always been acknowledging the challenges of the industries. From that perspective, the management at BA has gone through almost everything. So as we probably are moving into more of a digital age, we understand the challenges are no longer just about the airline industry, are about just about any aspect of the consumer proposition. And I think that's what is allowing us to focus on sharpening the service that we offer and the products that we need to offer to our customers. So I think it's a natural evolution of what BA management has gone through, understanding that, yes, we have to become more efficient, but beyond that, we have to really provide the best customer service possible.
And is that possible? Because, I mean, in the last year we've had a partial BA cabin crew strike on one of the fleets for issues about pay. There were tabloid press articles about, you know, staff who could hardly afford to do anything but sleep in their car before coming to work. How do you manage to still motivate staff to deliver the best frontline customer service and at the same time pay market competitive rates so that you can actually survive profitably as a business?
Well, it's absolutely possible, because I think all types of things are beginning to come together. And on one side, we have full support from our board to invest. So last year, we managed to get this support of £4.5 billion that will just go not just on airplanes, because anytime you hear about an airline and billions, that's airplanes, mm-hmm. but it goes way beyond airplanes. It's seats, it's new lounges, it's new food, it's new services on the ground for our passengers. Staff immediately begin to recognize that investment as we roll out new food, not just in Club World and long-haul flights, but also in premium economy, mm-hmm. in economy, as we begin to roll out new services on the ground at Heathrow Terminal 5 and other locations. Staff are seeing that investment is being made, and there's much more to come. So we have the investment coming on one side, and then ultimately we have an unbelievable, really, truly unbelievable opportunity next year, and that is our 100th anniversary.
Of British Airways.
So British Airways will be 100 years next year, and that is the time that we must seize to, not number one, prove to our customers that all this investment is coming to fruition, that BA is completely committed to being one of the absolute leaders in the world in terms of service and the products that we have to offer. And I think that is slowly, ever so slowly, beginning to get us into a very nice virtuous circle. Again, next year will be a great year to celebrate this.
Okay. Well, just think of it, it's what, two years to the month, I think, isn't it, since you officially took the helm. You've had, I think, quite a tough ride. If you think, again, of the UK media, who tends to be suspicious of any change, and as I say, I was wrong, there's been other non-Brits, but I don't know, you've attracted a high attention specifically for not being British. But one of the baptisms of fire that you had was coming up to a year ago, need I remind you, you know, the IT challenge when everything went into meltdown that weekend in May. And, you know, some people were prophesying that was the end of British Airways. You know, it happened to have been other airlines with some big, high-profile public challenges. But it was all over the UK media. There was, you know, customers being asked questions, comments about whether you'd handled it the right way. Is that issue now resolved, as far as you can ever say, for good? Are the lessons learned? And what would you do differently in the future if something like that happened again?
So 27th of May at 8:37 in the morning, someone did a series of things that eventually created the situation where we lost power in one of our data centers, which disabled our system for 6 hours and 42 minutes approximately, but basically made that infamous Saturday a day that we could not fly. And whilst the problem was contained to just that one day, which, by the way, in terms of IT disruptions, we've learned since then is pretty good, mm-hmm. The overall perception of the problem, and as we managed the individual itineraries of people, lasted a couple of days beyond that. So, yeah, a lot of people prophesize the end of British Airways, but it has happened many times before. Mm-hmm. Terminal 5 opening, yeah. And you know, many other events, and absolutely British Airways is very, very resilient to all these events. The important thing is, have we learned from it? And the answer is absolutely yes. And probably at two different levels, one from IT resilience and power resilience, and a great deal of work has been done since then to make sure that we move to an environment where there is significantly many more backups and have access to systems operationally that could potentially break down. It was, as usual, a bunch of coincidences taking place, combination of factors. So I think there has been learning beyond that. But I think that more than that, there have been some learnings around the customer experience. Some of them came into action on a bad day. We had on the 10th of December when the snow came in, last minute snow. And since then, we've had some really bad days in January and February. Mm-hmm. If you remember, even in March, we've had a couple of dodgy days. And there hasn't been much noise. And it is because we have been developing all kinds of technology tools and processes on the ground to be able to manage people's and customers' expectations much better. So I feel comforted that a great deal of effort and investment mm-hmm. has gone into disruption management, and it doesn't end. I chair a team once a month, and we go through 132 initiatives, and until they're done, we won't stop. And I think that that is the intent. BA, when everything works, works really, really well. And now we're absolutely intent to make sure that BA works really well when something happens.
Well, one thing on that particular IT induced weekend, that combination of circumstances that you described, was today, not only airlines, but businesses across multiple sectors rely on IT for communication. So you will often hear when there's disruption on rail or air services or indeed any other, go and look at this company's website or go and look on Twitter. But it seemed pretty well everything was down. You know, even your own decision support systems internally were down, or they were giving you different information. How, in this early part of the 21st century, do you get around that to at least have some kind of basic level of communication? I mean, that must have been a key part of what you really addressed.
You must remember those times when airlines' check-in systems would fail, and all of a sudden the check-in agents would have a map of the
seat
airplane,
plan.
Seat map.
Yeah.
And then you would have the stickers and put the stickers on boarding passes. Remember that. That still exists, by the way, in some places.
Okay.
We don't have that, but we have evolved as an industry. I think that you will find in the depths of most contingency plans something that looks more manual.
Mm-hmm.
So big boards that you can write, or even speakers that you can speak to manage crowds, continue to be somewhere deep into those contingency plans. Nowadays, technology also gives us other options. So even in the worst case scenarios, even when there are earthquakes, because we've been looking at the most disasters of disasters, and nowadays you can count on some infrastructure, and even in the disasters of disasters in remote areas, there are technologies that allows us through battery-operated devices and other kinds of networks to be able to operate. So I think that building that resilience, taking into account just about anything that could happen, is very important. And yes, some of those methods may appear more primitive. I don't think we'll use them as much in the future.
And you mentioned about punctuality of operation. An airline really is made or broken by its reputation on punctuality. And looking at British Airways over many years, I would say it's an airline that has gone through good and bad periods of punctuality. And of course, you have a challenge that Heathrow is so full as your main base. So when one small problem occurs, maybe completely unrelated to BA, the dominoes start to fall. You were describing there about the work that's gone into this. Do you think you've now gone as far as you can to really deliver a punctual service of operation, notwithstanding that Heathrow constraint?
No, we haven't. And I'm really, really pleased because in 2017, we increased our punctuality by 6 percentage points. And that really took us to the 80s, which is what we need to be in terms of 15-minute punctuality. And that's despite all that congestion that is discussed about in Heathrow. No, I think the investment that we're making on electric, partially motorized, automatic pushback vehicles, the fact that we've been installing self-service, not just baggage check-in, but boarding machines, which are extremely comfortable, by the way, in terms of just being able to board by using biometric methods. We are investing in many tools that are giving us access to just inching into that extra minute, extra 2 minutes, extra 3 minutes. We did change internally. Maybe this is a secret. I don't know. I'm going to tell you a secret. We did change the way that we measure punctuality internally. And we now measure it at departure time minus 5 minutes.
Okay.
So everything has to be completely ready to go at least 5 minutes before, or at last, I should say, at most 5 minutes before departure. And that's actually driving behavior within everyone involved.
I've actually been on one or two BA flights recently where we have actually left, I think as much as 10 minutes early, pushing back.
There's a huge push behind that. And yes, we do have slot constraints that we must adhere to.
No.
But ultimately, punctuality has been a huge drive over the last couple of years, continues to be so. Different committee, but really making inroads. And yes, we're investing where we need to invest, technology and people at times, to make sure that those airplanes can perform even higher. And I think we will, by the way. I think we will achieve the best punctuality of any home carrier in their home hubs despite that congestion.
Okay. Now, one particular challenge you face in that reliability of operation at the moment, which is not within your hands, but you have the very important 787 in your fleet, and we've heard news in the last few days that one version of the Rolls-Royce Trent 1000 engine has got more rectification work that needs to be done. It's going to be quite significant over time. It's going to impact on ETOPS, distance from diversion airport operations for some carriers. How much has that affected BA so far, and how well are you able to manage that? Because it must be a headache, which you can do without, especially in a summer program.
It is a headache, particularly indeed, as you think about the summer program, where we expect flights to be fuller and expectations to be very high. Well, we're working very closely with Rolls-Royce. Mm-hmm. We speak to them twice a day. I've been quite involved. I think they're doing the best that they can. They are looking at blade manufacturing, all these technical things. We have 26 787s at the moment, and out of a fleet of 300 airplanes. So we've got some ways in which we'll be able to hedge and protect should we need to do that with other aircraft across some of the routes. Is it a challenge? It is being a challenge. And we sincerely hope that Rolls-Royce will be able to not just feel comfortable that they have this particular technical challenge solved, but also will be able to continue to work with us very, very closely, because there is a lot of engines that need to be substituted very quickly
to
keep them running.
Have you had to lease in any aircraft? Because I think I read Virgin's had to get about four of the former Air Berlin A330s to cover.
Yeah, of course, for airlines like Virgin.
Your higher scale of operation.
Yes. So far we haven't. Okay. Maybe we will. It's hard to tell at this moment. I know the teams are working on it. I was meeting with part of the team this morning, and it is taking time from us. We want to make sure that we have airlift to all the flights that we've committed to fly.
Okay. Let's move on to some of the broader business issues. I was rummaging around on the internet the other day and found an interesting interview you did with one of the UK tabloid newspapers, I think, back in February, the Daily Mail. I can't claim it's a newspaper I would read very often, but I just get one soundbite out of that. You mentioned about the challenges.
I'm scared already.
You said this year, I think, is the year we sort ourselves out. Now, we've talked about the challenges, particularly of last year, but looking now, related to that quote, about BA's reputation, you described, the centenary coming up. BA is an airline that has always prided itself on premium service. And more importantly, we've got a room full of network planners here, airport, airline relationship management. They know all about the profit and loss. BA is an airline that has always needed high yield premium traffic, and it's had it in abundance at Heathrow. But I think it's fair to say BA has fallen behind prior to even you coming to the role in leading the way. You could say there were glory days in the 1980s, Lord King, Colin Marshall, Club World. I think it was the first time a business class cabin had been given a brand name. BA was so confident it was far ahead of the competition. But we've seen, of course, Asian carriers, Gulf carriers, even American carriers catching up. Tell us a bit more about how long it will take to get back up to scratch, because I know you are indeed working heavily on that premium end.
Well, I think we're making inroads.
Yeah.
And I think that we are... at the beginning, I don't know how to describe it, two-fifths of the work. And I'm using fifths because we already have a five-year business plan,
right,
and we're into year two. But I think we're making some inroads. If you come into Heathrow today as a premium customer, from the time you're dropped off at Terminal 5 until you're sitting down in the lounge having a glass of champagne, a passenger wrote to us and showed us a video. They'd done it in 4 minutes. Using the new first wing facility, and that takes you straight into the lounge. Beyond that, there are many small improvements that are taking place, not just at the premium end of the cabin, but also at the economy.
I'm going to come to the non-premium and ask you some specific questions.
Okay, so let's stick to the premium.
On that, but...
So on the premium side, today you go into you arrive into the baggage hall, and you find that there is a cordon off area in the baggage belt that says first class only. Mm-hmm. And you have BA staff that are actually pulling the bags out for first class passengers and hand delivering them to passengers and helping them with any queries they may have. We've done it with JFK, now we're doing it with LAX. And with that, I give you a very small example of many things that are happening at the premium end to make sure that we absolutely build a fantastic
product. Is first class itself, from BA's point of view, still a market to invest in? I mean, even at Heathrow, there are some routes now where you don't have a first configured aircraft. How many of those markets are still viable?
Many. So what we said 2 years ago at Investors Day was that we probably had too many overall first-class seats.
Right.
And what we needed to do is to have the right amount
of
first-class seats and put them on the right market. So, no, absolutely committed to first-class, and it goes by market. Let me take you back to the other question. The fact that, so when I arrived in 2016, a few months afterwards, I asked the board for £400 million to invest, begin investing very, very fast on the premium product. That gave birth to the new catering and club world, which is receiving fantastic reviews, and we continue evolving, particularly the delivery, not the food. The food is fantastic. And then last year, the $4.5 billion. And that gives us more room, a bigger budget, to be able to invest in that premium experience, and again, on the non-premium experience. But no, we think we can deliver an extremely high quality service. We are at the beginning of that process. I'm very excited about what's coming.
And in business class, I mean, some people, you know, subjectively around the industry say, well, BA, of course they can afford to give a less than brilliant service in business class. They've got Heathrow. If you want to go to Heathrow, you're going to go on BA. I'm sure you can argue the toss on that point, but you've got more investment coming there. You've talked about a new seat, but the challenge is you've got a pretty high, relatively high density of seats in a business cabin compared to some airlines, and you've talked about improving space with a new seat, but not putting prices up. How are you going to square that circle in terms of keeping your revenue margins there from that key segment of your long-haul traffic, especially?
Yeah. First of all, I categorically deny that BA can afford to have a sub-standard product. I think that we are precisely under a great deal of pressure to deliver not just at the same level, but beyond most of our competitors. Yeah. That's what our UK consumers expect.
Yeah.
That's the journey that we're in. In terms of business class seats, we believe we'll have a number of aircraft next year, already with a new club seat, and it will have all the features that our customers are asking for in terms of privacy, all aisle access, gate-to-gate, IFE, storage. There's 11 different features that we are purposely wanting to deliver. So none of those features that initially were fantastic 20 years ago when the club seat came up as the first lie-flat seat in the world, all of those will disappear, and there will be a new, more modern club seat, again, from the delivery of the first 350s next year. We acknowledge that. In terms of density, it will be whatever it will be. The fact that we are acknowledging that we don't need 14 seats, 12 seats in first class gives us a little bit of room. We have to get the equation right with premium economy and economy. And I think we got it.
And premium economy itself, I think to me that's more of a key tool for airlines like BA. I mean, you've had it, what, maybe 10 years or something like that now?
Yes.
But it's an important one because it acknowledges there are people traveling on business that they can't afford, they're not going to be able to afford a budget for business class, but they don't just want to be in there with everybody going on holiday. Yeah. How is that going to evolve? Because more airlines are cottoning onto the value of having this other segment.
It's evolving greatly. In fact, all the new refurbished 777s that are coming into Gatwick have a fairly large cabin, more than 40 seats in premium economy. So we absolutely acknowledge the value that that class has in the middle. Who would ever have imagined that we would have a four-class aircraft? But indeed we do, and it makes a difference, and we do seem to have access to a particular market that wants to upgrade beyond the standard economy ticket. We are looking at how else to make that particular product richer and demand a little premium over the economy seat, but full total commitment and probably a little bit of growth in terms of the total number of seats available in premium economy.
Okay, and the last element of premium in short haul, I mean, there's been thoughts in BA in the past about whether you'd even keep club class at all. Certainly at Gatwick was discussion it might go, but it's still there. I think it was under your own watch, Alex, but it came back on domestic. I can't remember when BA ever had it on domestic before. How has that worked out? Is it washing its face, or is it simply a necessity so that you have a seamless journey for people who've done a long haul onto short haul or vice versa?
I think necessity would be second. I asked the question internally. When I came in, I said, why don't we have a club cabin in domestic flights? And I was presented with evidence. And based on that evidence, I said, we ought to do it. And we did it, and it's very successful. And I think the necessity to provide a premium product for inbound club and first-class passengers into Heathrow long haul is part of that picture. But ultimately, the class itself sustains itself, and it's very successful. I think we are going to continue evolving on club product, and we are likely to evolve on softer stuff like catering and some of the service aspects of Club Europe. We started with Club World, We then went to World Traveler class. I think Club Europe, we will address before the end of the year around some aspects of the product offering overall, which I think will make it more premium itself. So Club Europe very much in the picture, both for domestic. I'm not sure if we call Club Europe the domestic flight, so that's I'll let you judge
Club
that.
Club UK or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Club. It's Club Class. There will be investment in that cabin. There's still passengers that are interested on paying a premium behind it. The fact that in Europe we have the ability to move the curtain up and down gives us additional flexibility. We will make sure that that product evolves.
Now, the economy cabin, lower margins in revenue, but a very big part of volume, a majority in terms of volume. A lot of flack about changes made short haul with the buy on board. It was all over the UK tabloid press last year. BA takes away the free cup of tea, the free gin and tonic, the free frozen, refrigerated croissant, whatever it was. How is that one year on?
I mean, and then there is Brexit.
It's all part of a malaise of the UK, isn't it?
Buy on board, Brexit. I mean, it's just all coming together. When I came into BA, I asked how much work had been done on this particular topic. And quite a bit of work had been done, but the decision hadn't been taken.
Right.
And to be quite honest, it was a no-brainer decision. And it was really interesting talking to our sister airlines, Iberia and Aer Lingus, saying, oh, it was terrible when we did it. But it was over a year later.
Yeah.
And in fact, we measure customer satisfaction religiously every month. And my guess is that by July, August, looking at how customer satisfaction is evolving around the buy on board product, we're going to be nearly in the same place we were when we're offering really, 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 lower quality food for free.
Okay.
And drinks. So the fact that we have a partnership with M&S, which gives you access to very familiar products, significantly higher quality product. The fact that we've been going through and taking nearly a year to work out the logistics, to work out the speed of serving the food, to work out what is it that people want to buy. Do we have enough Percy pigs on the airplane, etc. I think that that's something that has helped us a tremendous amount. So fully committed to the model. I think it will evolve. I think that BA is not going to be a sort of company that just comes out with this and it just stays. No. We've talked about pre-ordering food. We've talked about potential options for frequent flyers to have access to food differently. We've talked about Avios. I think there are many more things that we can do with the buy on board proposition that no other airline that has a buy on board proposition can do. And we will do them. Absolutely committed.
Okay. And conversely, long haul, just as people were prophesying there, long haul was going to go the same way. You're now upping your game. You're actually putting more food back on. I mean, it got down to the point, I think, when it was going down, that people were joking the second meal offer on some of the long haul flights was now a fun size Mars bar. But you're now going back to a fuller provision of meals. Was that a conscious change in thinking partway through the process?
Yes, and I don't know how intimate I should get with you on this, but the decision to review the economy food just about a year and a half, nearly 2 years ago, was probably not in line with the spirit of the work that we were doing. And ultimately, when the next cycle came to renew contracts and to take a look at, we immediately said we need to not just bring in quantity, but quality. So this is why today you have Magnum ice creams and you have the snack talk boxes and access to even more food. So yes, I think that overall for a long haul proposition, an airline like British Airways is going to continue offering not just free food, but it looks like lots of it.
Okay, great stuff. Moving on to more technical matters, but absolutely essential for the audience we have today, Alex. So looking at fleet and network, long-haul fleet, we touched on the 787 for the challenge reason, but the 787 is now, as you said, 26 aircraft in the fleet, a key aircraft in BA's long-haul development, A350 is coming, and the A380, the full fleet delivered. And still the venerable, my favorite, 747, still working around. I remember talking to you before that we'll all be sad in a few years' time when the last one operates its scheduled flight. But on that particular point, when the 747s go, are you not going to find you're short of capacity because these are bigger aircraft? Or is it that you simply, the configuration of them now, you're not really going to notice because you have them in a lower density cabin format?
So several things. Whilst many of us in this room will absolutely feel sad when that last 747 flies off, whatever ends up in 2024, mm-hmm. By then there are likely to be a lot of perhaps younger consumers who will be thinking, what is the 747? It looks old. I don't want to fly it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we kind of like the 747 a great deal, but not everyone does. So, number one thing that we've done, and this was a decision slightly counterintuitive for a lot of people in BA, and that was a decision taken late last year, was to commit to refurbish the remaining 747s. Mm-hmm. So even though, except a couple that will be leaving the fleet, I think this year, beginning of next, the 747 fleet is being refurbished because we believe we have to, even though those airplanes will continue to fly for a number of years, we need to make sure that we're consistent yeah. with the product. And when you measure customer satisfaction of the non-refurbished 747s with the refurbished 747s, mm-hmm. clearly there's a huge difference. So new entertainment system with more movies, etc., and many aspects of the cabin are being redone on that 747. Beyond that, we are very carefully monitoring what the big providers are doing with regards to wide-body capacity. So we're trying to find out more about what the 777X will mean, or -9 will, mm-hmm. will mean in terms of number of seats and different configurations of the airplanes. Next year, we start the 351,000. If we didn't have enough aircraft types, mm-hmm. let's get one more.
Have another one.
Absolutely. Sorry, that's there's a airline manual. It says how to run airlines. And chapter one normally says, don't have too many aircraft types. Mm-hmm. And so we need to work on that.
Going in the opposite direction.
We need to work on that. Yeah. So the 351,000 is an excellent yeah. aircraft. New technology. We have many partners like Finnair who have been using it and are extremely satisfied mm-hmm. with it. We take the 1000-1000 variant, which Qatar has taken, and we're quite interested to see how that's going to work out. Many more seats, access to a different type of product altogether, so we're excited about it. You are right in terms of capacity. We have some time to do that planning. I think that it would be fair to say that sometime in the next few years, we will initiate, together with IAG, some sort of more formal mm-hmm. Investigation in terms of wide-body options.
And from Airbus's point of view, and I know I've asked the same question to Willie, there is a glimmer of hope, IAG, not necessarily BA, but most probably, you might yet take a few more on the right financial conditions.
Yes.
But not decided.
The last thing that you said is the most important one.
Exactly.
So the 380, we have 12 yeah. 380s, and it's a good performing aircraft. Passengers absolutely love the aircraft. And if we were to find the right financial conditions, I'm pretty sure that IAG and, as an extension, BA would consider them.
And the kind of routes you fly, I mean, IAG acquired British Midland, about 4 years ago now, three or four years
yeah,
ago.
Four.
You added slots at Heathrow. I know you would acquire a few slots here and there through a slot trading process when that comes available. What is the focus in terms of network development at Heathrow? I mean, North Atlantic is the powerhouse, but what about other markets, long haul, such as naturally Asia, China in particular?
I had breakfast with my team this morning, Gatwick, Heathrow, and City. And it's just tremendous to get a sense for the degree of ambition that we have to continue growing the network at Heathrow. And if you look at what's happening at Heathrow over the last three, 4 years, you have seen many more short-haul leisure destinations and continuing to add long-haul destinations mm-hmm. in a completely slot-restrained environment. So I fully support my team looking at options. You might find ourselves flying maybe a couple of fewer frequencies to a particular destination and then adding Nashville or adding New Orleans as a destination. We are absolutely committed to looking at how we can open new markets from Heathrow. Beyond that, we had this opportunity to have access to some additional slots in Gatwick, and that was the Monarch slot transaction last November.
I just wanted to ask you about that at Gatwick. Just to finish off on Heathrow, I mean, the new runway should be coming.
Should be coming.
You know, we've got the political process going on. Even if it does materialize, do you see a way out of the impasse? IAG, you know, the parent group and your good colleague, we all know and love him, Willie Walsh, has been very vocal about the cost of that new runway. Are you optimistic that one runway will be built and you'll get it at a cost that you believe will work for your business in the marketplace?
Yeah, just to clarify, my colleague is my boss.
Your boss,
indeed. In this respect. Yeah. I'm absolutely convinced that IAG is doing a fantastic job. I continue to drive the agenda. I think it's in absolutely everyone's interest. I was slightly depressed when I was talking about this with my wife in the kitchen a few months ago. And she said, you know, how long could it take for the third runway to be built? And I said, well, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years. And all of a sudden, my 20-year-old daughter came from the side and said, by that time, you will be a grandpa. And sort of dissipated all kind of put away all the...
All sense of hope.
Yeah, all sense of hope in some respects. I think there's a lot of work to be done, and IIG is quite involved in it. It's great to have IIG very focused around this issue. They're doing a great job.
And they've thrown into this pot, this idea of terminal competition. I mean, we talk about airport competition, but actual terminals within the airport. That's quite a new one. I don't think there's any other examples in the UK, certainly there are in the US and Europe.
Yeah, we are the main leaseholders and own this terminal in New York, T7. So it's not a foreign concept to us. We're familiar with what it means to have that sort of access to that sort of asset. I think there's a lot of work to be done yet. So it's difficult to speculate in terms of what the future models will be. If there's one common thread throughout all of this, and it has to come up in a conversation, particularly with this audience, is there's undoubtedly a direct relationship between the overall price of a ticket and how much demand is created.
Yeah.
Taxes are extremely high in Heathrow. We need to make sure that we reach a point in which any future development has to be aware of that, and it has to result in a neutral effect in terms of taxes. So that's where the focus is. Terminal, no terminal, runway, it has to work financially.
Now, what about, with that cost issue in mind, short-haul routes at Heathrow? Part of the reason for the government backing a runway at Heathrow is greater connectivity domestically. There's going to be airports in this audience, Alex. I'm sure you've had them bending your ear already. Some from the UK market who are happy that BA is maintaining or adding frequency. I can think of at least one or two others who are not so happy that frequency is coming down, the timetable is getting a little bit inconsistent. What is your focus on that short-haul part of the piece at Heathrow?
The picture that we have at the moment is what it is, and I think that my team continues to fine-tune it in either direction in terms of adjusting downwards and upwards. I think that having domestic connectivity is important for us, for our whole network, to be able to connect. We cannot underestimate the overall evolution of the train service. Faster trains being provided by more operators, a subject of a great discussion on its own, without a doubt. I think that if there is additional capacity in Heathrow, or when there is additional capacity in Heathrow in the future, there will be more connectivity. There will be other operators, or even ourselves, that as we look at opportunities and being able to fly to more places, there will be more airports that will be connected within the UK, domestically, and of course, outside of the UK. So I recognize the challenge. Much work that we have to continue doing and fine-tuning.
Absolutely. Alex, just quickly to acknowledge, if anybody has a burning question, something we think we must cover before we finish in 30 minutes, just drop it on the iPad. I've got plenty more on the list, but just in case, I don't want to have anybody disappointed before you head off your flight. You mentioned Gatwick, obviously. Big operation for BA. It's become bigger because I believe you managed to get about half of the Monarch slots. What is the plan for Gatwick? It's a very different market. Your approach to operation is very different, both long-haul and short-haul.
So the first run at the Gatwick slots that Monarch used to operate is really more of the same. So the destination network will be flying this coming summer.
A lot more leisure routes and some extra frequencies.
Leisure routes, so it'll be more Malagas, more sun and beach, etc. It's what we could do in a short period of time. Combination of our own aircraft and some leased aircraft. I think the big emphasis right now is what do we do next year? And everyone has an ambition of adding additional long-haul routes, no doubt about it. So I think that we're trying to look at what the options are. We need to find aircraft that will be able to fly those distances. And the work continues. We're just really glad to have access to a new set of slots in Gatwick. It's a great operation. I was in Gatwick last week. It feels different. The team there is measuring the way they deliver their services on an hourly basis. They are very agile. They've worked really, really hard throughout the years, and it hasn't been easy for them. But today, they're in a really great place. The Gatwick overall team is fantastic. Their cost base is extremely competitive. I'm extremely encouraged, and when the Monarch slot opportunity came through, I remember talking about it and said, we cannot miss this, because we have a great opportunity to develop Gatwick further.
Okay. Now, the other one you mentioned when you saw your team in London City, which is becoming bigger and bigger with City Flyer operating there. How would you see that? I know the CEO of London City is here. Maybe you've run into him in your brief time here. But they are growing massively. I mean, I think, what is it, 4.5 million a year now, going to about 6. You're a big part of that. Is that a very different niche? Is it still the sharp-suited business traveller, or has that also evolved in the last few years?
I think it's evolving a little bit. If you go into our website and you say, I want to go to Ibiza for a few days, not only Gatwick and Heathrow show up, but mm-hmm. also City. So you'll have all kinds of passengers going to City Airport and go, wow, look at this. It's smaller, security goes faster. It's a different experience than the larger airports, Gatwick and Heathrow. We have a good partnership with London City Airport. They also have a responsibility. Growth will be linked to the degree of investment that they made and how willing they are to engage with airlines such as ourselves. The fleet and the team in City, which quietly works slightly separate from the rest of the BA team, doing a great job, by the way, has been experimenting outside of London. Mm-hmm. So for the nearly third year running this summer, we'll be flying from destinations that don't touch London, with
Bristol, I think, and
Bristol. We've
Birmingham.
Done Birmingham in the past. We've done Manchester, and flying to leisure destinations from there. Probably the only airlines flying with a club product to mm-hmm. these destinations.
And you sell some club seats when
and
they're on
And we
offer?
Sell some club seats, which when you have 1 billion seats to Ibiza, all of a sudden to have a couple of seats on club does drive some demand. So we'll continue experimenting in that way. I think the team is quite keen. And let's see where it takes us. No, don't know yet.
Absolutely. Now, the competitive environment for the last few minutes. Competition is changing. Long haul, low cost. I mean, you're waiting for this, of course, Alex. So we can't get away from long haul, low cost. We talked about it with Willie in the autumn. Then we talked specifically about Norwegian. Willie said, I admire Bjorn. You know, it's incredible what he's done. He's taught us lessons, which we're now taking up with Level. You're densifying 777s in Gatwick. You have a very cost competitive aircraft there. You've come head to head on routes. Then we had the bombshell news, at least for those of us outside of IAG, bombshell a couple of weeks ago with the acknowledgement that IAG had built up a stake in Norwegian. Now, I know what you're going to tell me, you can't say much, Alex, but interesting step. Long haul, low cost more broadly, just as a first point, is on the rise, and you've already been reacting whether we had this news about Norwegian or not.
And I can't say much.
But Gatwick, you've been taking some actions, haven't you, already?
I'm just kidding.
You've been identifying aircraft.
No, you're exactly right. I think when I first came in, I saw what the Gatwick team had been doing over a long period of time. And the challenge was to understand how an airline like BA could ultimately deliver a quality product and be competitive at the same time in Gatwick, particularly some of the routes that some of our competitors were starting. By the way, not just the one you mentioned, but mm-hmm. going to Canada and via Iceland to other places, exactly. et cetera, et cetera. And I think the answer to that has been these new 777. And the new 777, of which we're getting about one new refurbished one.
When you say new, not brand new, newly refurbished.
Newly refurbished, yeah. 777, which, by the way, I was in inside of the aircraft last week when I went to Gatwick, and it's fantastic. You go inside as a passenger, and it's a brand new aircraft with a brand new entertainment system and USB charge points, and it looks fantastic. Of course, with a new onboard product, that makes a huge difference, not just in premium, but in non-premium. But the most important thing is that this aircraft, with the combination, the cabin configuration, refurbished, gives us a very good opportunity to compete effectively. So from a British Airways point of view, I'm quite satisfied that this is going to be quite an interesting platform to compete. Gatwick is the right place, mm-hmm. Definitely, to start this up. Beyond that, well, you said it all. IAG made the decision to start up Level, extremely successful from Barcelona last year, and this year we'll be flying from Paris, and then the news of last week, which I can't comment on it because there isn't much more to come.
IAG, since its birth, I mean, Willie's often described, he sees IAG as a consolidator, an industry consolidator, and so far the acquisition, including Vueling, your previous life, Aer Lingus most recently, those airlines have joined the group, and the evidence so far is they have become stronger. They all have to contribute, but part of the ethos in IAG is you compete with your colleagues. I mean, BA is the biggest, but it's not a guarantee that you get the A350-1000. It could be Iberia, it could be Aer Lingus. Is that a key driver of your thinking every day? That, you know, Willie might say, sorry, Alex, you thought you were going to have that, but, you know, Luis Gallego has come up with something better, or Stephen Kavanagh in Aer Lingus? Or...
Yes, it's very much there. The lucky part of it is that the four or five chief execs, we've been working together for quite a long time, mm-hmm. and we know each other very well. Luis and I started Click Air together in 2006. Javier has been in Iberia, and of course, Stephen, we've known each other for a long time. And there's a sense of teamwork there. And yes, we all have our own identities, and we all have our own heart and wishes and pride around our brand, without a doubt. But yes, there's a sense that IAG makes the decisions in terms of where, how capital is allocated. Okay. And therefore, there is a tremendous sense of making sure we deliver the best metrics. Mm-hmm. And by the way, metrics today, I was thinking, is not just financial.
Yeah.
There's a tremendous competition internally, very, very healthy competition around NPS, mm-hmm. Net Promoter Score, yeah. customer satisfaction scores.
Of course.
And we all want to excel on that area, and that means investment the right way and providing the best service, the best punctuality. But yes, that's the environment that we're in. And I think IAG is probably the only airline group that does it this way, and hence mm-hmm. you see their results.
I mean, one thing we do know publicly, if we look at Norwegian, they announced recently their Q1 loss will be higher than expected. They went out for a liquidity raising to shareholders. Everybody in the industry outside of Norwegian, I think indeed in Norwegian, is talking about this massive expansion. So just, you may or may not be tempted to give an answer or not, Alex, but just playing it out. With that philosophy of being an industry consolidator, this would be one amazing consolidation step. And I think I will certainly see that BA would be very active in your personal brain, intellect power. I'm not trying to flatter you overly, Alex. You can just pay me the backhander later. No, would be very involved in that process. But I guess we have to wait for more public news.
I'll give you a very comprehensive answer. Yes.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Yeah, other competition. I mean, the Gulf carriers, where are they these days? In your figures, BA, Qatar is a partner and an investor in IAG. They've all had different challenges in the last year. Etihad shrinking, all of them dealing with whether it's sanctions or restrictions on traffic and so on.
Well, Qatar is not a partner, not just a partner and shareholder.
Investor.
It's a great partner.
Yeah.
We have a Qatar joint business on Doha routes. We recently signed an enhanced agreement with them, which gives UK consumers access to even more routes via Doha. It gives us more flexibility to continue working with them. So Qatar is not just any partner, it's a great partner, like American Airlines is with us in the Atlantic. Really can't comment on the rest. We all are equal witnesses and observers of what's happened to Etihad and what's happened to Emirates.
Mm-hmm.
We are just keen on competing effectively and making sure that our product standards are very high. I often have discussions with some of our home airports about how, you know, frankly, we should have as good of an experience, airport airline experience on the ground as any of those fantastic Gulf. Why not? Absolutely,
yeah.
Why not? And Heathrow is very keen on it, and we are turning. You now have British Airways Jaguars connecting you from one airplane to another. Yes, British Airways, amazing. And many, many, many small features that are attending to the requirements of those passengers that are less price sensitive in many respects. So I think those guys are all in different situations. We are closer to Qatar. We're very enthusiastic about working together with them. They have some definite knowledge about the region and onward connections. We have knowledge on the European side and the Atlantic side. So we'll continue cooperating with them for sure.
Alex, so 2 minutes left. You've got a flight to run for. You're a real tech fan, I know that. We're in a digital world more and more. The men and women in this room today, network planners, airport airline relationship management, are using different tools. What does it mean, not only from a customer-facing point of view, whether we're using an app, we're checking in at home, we're doing biometric boarding, what about shaping the business, all this data now available for business processes and efficiency and thinking forward into what happens next?
So I'm going to ask myself a different question and answer mm-hmm. that. And the question
okay.
that I'm often asked is, what are my biggest challenges in BA? And I always say people is number one, because I have a great team, and making sure that we are 100% aligned, delivering very fast, fantastic service and product. The second challenge is technology. We have access to so much data. When people first coined the term big data, I used to think, yes, airlines have always been big data. It's just now that we're beginning to learn how to use that big data. And there's a lot of work to be done yet. I'm not sure that we know you well enough, or any of you, and yet we have the data behind it. So a lot of emphasis is going to understand the consumer side, and obviously to help us make the right decisions. Behind every root decision, there is not just a spreadsheet, but a bunch of other systems that allows us to take a look at a green, amber, or red indicator that ultimately tells us if we should be making business with you or not. So technology is always going to be probably after people, the most important influence in the decisions that we make.
Alex, we're down to 38 seconds now. 2 years on, we talked about a rough ride, but just looking at the smile on your face, the enthusiasm with which you've answered as far as you can answer the questions. Sounds like you've enjoyed the first 2 years. Are you looking forward to the next two?
I'm looking forward to many years in BA. It's a great place to be.
Well, listen, you're eager to get back and get on with it, so we're going to let you go. Alex Cruz, Chairman and CEO of British Airways, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Alex. Thank you, as you said.
And safe flight
back.
Thank you very much. Better run.
Great.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to see you.